Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back my great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyth, a professor of family medicine at UNC. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
You know, on our show today, but we're going to be able to hear a recent interview we conducted with Dr. Beth McGinney, assistant professor of health policy and management and mental health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the media's portrayal of mental illness. So I hope we'll understand a little bit better about ways we can destigmatize the mental health portion of this picture. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters. And our very first one, let's just dive right in. It's about these things called activity trackers, with a lot of different brand names of these sorts of things that kind of encourage you to do physical fitness and track how many steps you get.
Right. And so there is a group of researchers at the University of Pittsburgh who were trying to figure out whether you could use one of those activity trackers to continue to help you lose weight, stay fit, and all the sort of good things that come from the physical activities. And so they picked out 470 individuals between the ages of 18 and 35 with a body mass index over 25, which means they're overweight, or all the way up to 39, which means they're very obese. And it was a nicely selected group. About 77% of them were women and 29% were from minority communities. And what they did was interesting. It was a two-year study, and for the first 6 months, everybody got counseling and sessions about weight loss, staying fit. And then at 6 months, they divided the group into two parts. One of them continued to have the counseling sessions, and the other one was given one of these fitness monitors to strap on their arm.
And I would have predicted that the group that got the fitness monitoring would have lost more weight in the next 6 months than the one that just stayed with the counseling. That's what I would have predicted.
And it would have been a money loser if you put any bets on it, because it's exactly what did not happen.
Wow.
The fitness parameters and the diet and activity was apparently fine among everybody, but the weight loss continued to increase when the ones that had the classes and the ones that used the fitness trackers did not. So it was quite a bit of difference between the two groups.
And this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, not on some obscure journal. This seems counterintuitive. And I know there has been other studies that have shown, you know, benefit. It doesn't mean these patients didn't benefit from becoming more physically fit, does it?
Right. The only thing that stuck out was the weight loss. 7.7 pounds in the group was using the fitness trackers and 13 pounds in the ones who continued to have the counseling. Now, I got to tell you, I went over to Greensboro to an AHEC CME not that long
ago. One of these area health education centers, training of providers around healthcare.
And around weight issues specifically. And I listened to the people who were there to testify to their own issues with weight, and there was a lot of emotion. And I just can't help but think that the group provides people the opportunity to see other people, to talk, to interact, whereas this thing on your arm is just you again. And I can see how that could have influenced it, although I'm not trying to say what the real reason was.
You know, we run a weight management program, as you probably know, Bob, at the University of North Carolina that we started over a year ago. And one of the things that we've noticed is that we do try to get people more physically active, because that has tremendous benefits on quality of life regardless of whether or not they lose weight. So perhaps the outcome was the wrong outcome here. We work on intensive weight management like they did in this study. And I think the wrong message from the study would be to abandon the physical fitness part. It's to intensify the behavioral management and recognize that there is a lot more to being physically fit than just losing weight.
Yeah.
I think that this research is important, but it is not the say-all.
And the other thing I'd say that is, if you have a real weight issue, you need to be careful with the fitness exercises that you're doing so that you don't damage cartilage while you have that weight. You need to get the weight down before you start really doing the impactful stuff on hips and knees.
Great advice. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is some research that we've brought up on the show in the past, and we actually discussed not too long ago in some respects when we had the director of the University of North Carolina's microbiome project on. And that's about allergies in young children and the impact of kind of avoiding exposure to certain foods versus perhaps encouraging earlier exposure?
So for a lot of years, there's a lot of doctors that have said if you have a kid that has allergy in the family or is allergy prone, that you ought to wait 2 or 3 years to start giving the kid the things that tend to cause allergies. And eggs and peanuts are two of the more common allergies that kids can get.
And this was what was called one of those systematic reviews where they reviewed data from 146 studies over the last 70 years. And basically they said that if you really delay giving these kids exposure to things like eggs and peanuts, they actually have more allergies than if they're exposed early. Now, granted, there are some real big caveats here. One is that this would be very different for kids at very high risk of developing food allergies. So children with severe eczema who have existing food allergy, multiple siblings, multiple parents with food allergies, the peanut allergies. You don't want to give peanuts to a young child. These are some things that would be clear.
You don't give peanuts to a young child because they can choke on it, but you can give peanut butter, and then that, of course, is not going to happen.
And this was actually in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We're going to ask our health sciences librarians to put a little link up there. It's an important research, and we would encourage you to actually, if you're having a young child or expecting, talk with your doctor about this research. The answer is perhaps different than what some people might expect.
But you can't pass up the obvious, which they had 46% lower egg allergies in the kids that ate between 4 and 6 months the first time. And for peanuts, it was 71% lower for kids that ate early on. So that's got to be an important finding. And he did study a lot of other studies with similar things, similar outcomes.
Speaking of new research, this next one actually was like one of these aha ones, which is like, there's a new risk factor I probably didn't know about and need to be aware of, and that's for Crohn's disease. This is a condition along with certain other inflammatory bowel diseases, things that affect your gastrointestinal tract that can cause diarrhea, blood, pain, fever. People can get very, very sick and sometimes need surgery.
Sometimes they actually perforate their colons or small bowel, and then that really gets dicey. But this comes out of Case Western Reserve University's Center for Mycology, meaning the study of fungus kind of organisms. And the spokesman for the study is Mahud Gandrum. And basically, they say that there have been some bacteria correlated with people that have Crohn's disease. And this is the first study that's found that there's a fungus, which also, and it's called Candida tropicalis. So what they did was they took 9 families in Belgium and France that had people with Crohn's in the family, and they had 4 families in the same geographic area that were free of this. And they cultured the biome in their gut, and they found that the triumvirate of E. coli, Serratia marcescens, and Candida tropicalis, if you had those 3 things, you were much more likely to have Crohn's disease.
Bottom line is that people naturally harbor between 9 and 23 fungal species in their mouths alone. And there's obviously a complex role in how people may develop Crohn's, and alteration and fungi in addition to bacteria may be responsible. Interesting research about having a healthy microbiome. Our last research that matters, Bob, is about smoking, one of the areas that I've had a particular area of research interest for a couple decades, and what its impact is on the human genome, a process called DNA methylation by which cells control gene activity. And this is research that was in the journal Circulation, the American Heart Association's journal. Real briefly, what did they find in this?
Well, they did a meta-analysis of 16,000 patients and looked at
This methylation,
DNA methylation process. And they found that smoking-associated demethylation sites are common in more than 7,000 genes.
Which is a third of known human genes, which is unbelievable, which helps us understand how is that smoking's linked to all these cancers.
And they also found that people that stopped smoking, the majority of their DNA metabolism sites returned to normal levels and like never smokers, but some persisted as long as 30 years. And the notion is that the genes then go awry and cause bad things like cancer and heart disease or whatever.
Yeah, so the bottom line is here is that smoking cessation really does make sense. It does alter or help repair your DNA if you quit. And if you persist, the DNA changes are really pervasive. So that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be able to hear an interview with Dr. Beth McGinney, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management and Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the media's portrayal of mental illness. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaithen. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, I have the opportunity to talk with Dr. Beth McGinty, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management and Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the media's portrayal of mental illness. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. McGinty.
Thanks for having me.
You know, this is such an important issue that affects, I think, in one way or another, almost everyone in the country. And before we really dive right into the topic in your research, perhaps you can start off telling us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested both in public health and specifically the effects of violence?
You know, I've always been interested in health and well-being. It's a passion I had from a very young age, and I was interested in mental illness and substance use, particularly based on family experience and friends' experiences with those issues growing up. And that led me to eventually go on to become a researcher focused on mental health services and policy. And being a researcher in that area, you know, much of the national dialogue, particularly in the last decade around mental illness, has really focused on the relationship between mental illness and violence. And so the timeliness of the topic and the focus on it in the news media and elsewhere in the public dialogue really led me to want to learn more, to understand what the research evidence says about that relationship, and as in this study, to learn how news media coverage is dealing with this issue and how that might influence public attitudes.
I remember over a decade ago, almost 2 decades ago now, in Chapel Hill, when a student on our Franklin Street, the main kind of street running in downtown Chapel Hill, brought out a gun and started shooting, and people were killed. And I remember the first thing that I read about was that this was a schizophrenic. And it really just stuck with me that the diagnosis of the event was labeled with mental illness. Talk to us a little bit about how that perception comes to play in America.
Well, this is something, the example that you just gave is something that we see all the time in the news media. These examples of a horrific violent act that is attributed to someone with a mental illness, particularly a serious mental illness, like you said, schizophrenia or another psychotic disorder like bipolar disorder, for example. And this is a narrative that we as Americans are now very familiar with because we've heard so many of these examples in our lives or seen them in our communities. And we can talk more about this, but that apparent narrative of a strong link between mental illness and violence actually misrepresents what the research evidence says about the actual epidemiologic relationship between mental illness and violence. And so it creates a misperception in the public's mind that most people with mental illness are likely to be violent, that much of violence is caused by mental illness, when in reality that is not the case.
So what is the data on mental illness and gun violence, or mental illness and violence? How do we begin to separate fact from fiction?
Well, so, you know, looking at the sort of data separately, you know, we know that mental illness is very common. It affects about 20% of Americans in a given year, about 50% over the course of their lifetime. And when you sort of counted in personal experience through a family member or friend, like you said, to start us off, almost everybody has experience with mental illness. So starting with sort of the idea that mental illness is very, very common, it probably resonates that most people with mental illness, given that, you know, 20% of Americans in a given year have mental illness, most of those people are never violent toward others. That said, we do know that in a small number of cases and in a small number of scenarios, people with, in particular, serious mental illness, psychotic conditions, are at elevated risk of violence. And that often has to do with the symptoms associated with psychosis, hallucinations and delusions, in particular persecutory delusions where someone is under the misimpression that they are being threatened by someone. You know, naturally a threat response is often to lash out, be violent in a protective way. So we know that those symptoms can be associated with violence. However, those symptoms can also be controlled in the large majority of cases very effectively with medication. These are treatable conditions. So even among those with conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, the large majority of people, over 80%, are never violent towards others, even in a push or shove or hit kind of way, never mind a gun violence sort of way, which is far more rare. So I just walked through the epidemiology of what is the prevalence of violence among people with mental illness. The other relevant piece here is that we have very good research evidence showing that the large majority of violence in the U.S. is not caused by mental illness. So only about 4%, the estimate is 3 to 5%, so I think 4% of all violence, gun violence, all interpersonal violence, so violence directed towards other people, is caused by mental illness.
Tell me what the problem is and how you came up with this idea to really study how the media portrays this. Because clearly then this is an issue that people perceive more linked than is the reality.
Yeah, so studying news media coverage of social issues is a well-established way in the public health and political science and communication fields of assessing the national dialogue about different topics. The news media coverage is a good proxy for the national conversation about different things. And so looking at news coverage of mental illness over especially an extended period of time is a good way of assessing, you know, has the dialogue about mental illness changed over the last 20 years, and what's being focused on in that news media coverage gives us some clues about what might be driving some of the public attitudes around mental illness violence.
And we would think that things, at least my impression, would be, well, we're becoming more tolerant, we're becoming more understanding, so that the media, which reflects society, would be doing better at this. Is that what you found?
So it's not what we found. I would have hypothesized the same thing. You know, we know from survey data that people have more knowledge about mental illness than we did 20, 30 years ago, right? There's a much greater understanding that mental illness has neurobiological causes. We know people are more willing to disclose their mental illness, more willing to seek treatment for their mental illness, all positive signs. And so I would have, you know, perhaps expected that we saw some more positive news coverage of mental illness over time. What we found was that over the entire 20-year period that we looked at, 1995 to 2014, there was actually very little change in the content of news media coverage about mental illness. And across that entire period, the most frequent topic covered was violence.
Wow. Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we come back, I really want to explore really why is this the case? And, you know, is it the public? Is it the media? Is it society? What do we need to do to really kind of change this? We're talking with Dr. Beth McGinty, assistant professor of health policy and management and mental health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the media's portrayal of mental illness. We'll be right back with your health. Please stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. We've been talking with Dr. Beth McGinty, assistant professor of health policy and management and mental health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the media's portrayal of mental illness. And right before the break, Dr. McGinty, you were talking about how things hadn't changed over 20 years, which was kind of disheartening to me and maybe many of our listeners. And I wonder, you know, is the stigma of mental health still there? And so if you say schizophrenia and one thinks about violence, does that connotate certain elements that are resistant? What do we know about stigma?
That's a great question. So the trends in public stigma, so stigma directed at people with mental illness, very much mirror this trend of no change in the proportion of news stories focused on violence. We have good national survey data showing that since we first started measuring stigma at a population level in the 1950s, it's really persisted. Even as I was saying before, in the face of sort of major improvements in treatment and acceptability and willingness to seek treatment, you know, changes in literacy around mental illness, this public stigma has persisted. And there's a large body of research trying to understand what are the roots of mental health stigma and why is it so persistent. And it does appear that beliefs about violence and the fear that those beliefs engender really are one of the key drivers of continued stigma towards people with mental illness. And so that, frankly, makes it even more concerning that we're seeing this continued emphasis on violence in news media coverage, which is reaching, you know, millions of readers and viewers each year. Because it's just sort of continuing and propagating those misperceptions of a link between mental illness and violence, leading to that fear and that stigma.
So can you give us some specific examples of the way the news you studied cover mental illness and violence?
So the most frequent thing that you see is the news media is reporting on a specific act of violence committed by a person with mental illness, or in some cases, there's not actually documented mental illness, but the reporter writing the news story sort of hypothesizes or assumes that there might be a role of mental illness, which still links mental illness with violence in the mind of readers, of course. So as one might expect, in the past decade, we saw very prominent news stories about mass shootings. And we have had several mass shootings in this, you know, past 5 and 10 years where mental illness did play a documented role. For example, the Tucson shooting where Gabrielle Giffords was wounded and many others were killed and wounded. That perpetrator was subsequently diagnosed with, you know, previously undiagnosed and untreated schizophrenia. So one example of a news story would be stories about, you know, that mass shooting and the fact that this shooter did turn out to have serious mental illness. And the majority of news stories about mental illness and violence are along those lines, although, of course, not all of them are about an act of violence so high profile as a mass shooting. It could be about, you know, we sort of hate to frame it this way, but a smaller or more minor act of violence in the community.
What are some of the consequences of the media's portrayal of mental illness and violence the way it does?
Well, we have good research showing randomized experiments showing that news stories depicting violence by people with mental illness do in fact increase stigma. So we have a causal relationship there, right? Exposure to all of this violence focus in the news media does increase stigma toward people with mental illness. And of course, we know that stigma is associated with a range of other negative outcomes, including unwillingness to seek treatment and lack of support for policies and services that might benefit this group, right? Stigma is associated with, for example, decreased public support for, increased government funding of community-based mental health services. I think the broader implication here is that it just, as we alluded to earlier, sort of continues the misperception that mental illness is strongly linked to violence and leads to, as a result, in some cases, sort of inappropriate policy preferences, right? If we believe that most people with mental illness are violent, then perhaps we're more likely to support things like involuntary treatment. If we believe that most violence is caused by mental illness, perhaps we might support expanding mental health treatment as a solution to gun violence in the U.S. And while expanding mental health treatment would help many people, it's not going to solve gun violence in the U.S. So I think there are a lot of implications of that inappropriate linkage in terms of support for policy down the line.
So if you're able to help the media, I know that what we shouldn't do, but what should we do? So what would be your advice be to ensure that there's responsible reporting and representation of mental illness? What's it look like?
So this is tricky because in some ways, reporters are not doing anything wrong here, right? In the Tucson mass shooting example that I gave, there was a documented role of schizophrenia, and so I would not expect a reporter not to mention schizophrenia in that news story. I think what the guidance is, there are a couple of points. One is, in the absence of a documented role of mental illness and violence, don't speculate about it in the news story or assume that there is a role of mental illness. So a good example of this was the Newtown shooting, the horrific mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. We know very little about the mental health status of that shooter. It's a young man who had some developmental disabilities. He may well have been experiencing the onset of a serious mental illness. We don't know. He killed himself after committing the mass shooting. However, news media coverage just sort of broadly assumed that mental illness was involved and reported that shooting as though there were a role of schizophrenia or serious mental illness there, despite the fact that there wasn't one that was documented. So avoiding that kind of speculation and assumption, I think, is one important thing that can be done, including corrective information, sort of broad population-level information in news stories about mental illness and violence, where you say, we're talking about an example of someone with schizophrenia who committed an act of violence, but most people with schizophrenia are never violent toward others. Most violence is not caused by schizophrenia, is another recommendation for responsible reporting. And then I think a really big one is to encourage more reporting of positive stories about mental illness. So while I mentioned that we know that news stories about mental illness and violence increase stigma, we have evidence showing that news stories about successful treatment and recovery, news stories about societal level barriers to care, those don't increase stigma and can, in fact, decrease stigma, particularly stories about successful treatment and recovery. But we're seeing very little or very few of those types of stories in the news media. So de-emphasizing stories about violence in favor of positive stories about mental illness is probably ultimately what needs to happen to really make a dent in stigma.
Yeah, it seems to me that sometimes we're looking for a reason. And so that mental health becomes, we could have a reason for it. So therefore, we could have prevented something. And maybe that's the case, maybe it's not. But what then gets lost in your suggestion is what we're missing is compassion for those that are suffering mental illness, had nothing to do with this, but yet may be judged. And that compassion is really important.
Absolutely.
If you could leave our listeners with one final thought, what would it be?
Just to emphasize that, mental illness, even or especially serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, are treatable health conditions. And people with these conditions can do very well with appropriate treatment and services. They can live successful, fulfilling lives in the community like the rest of us. And this media emphasis on violence is really misleading about this population.
Well, we really appreciate your research, Dr. Beth McGinty, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management and Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Your research to bring the message that we need to take a step back and think about the positive portrayals and the realistic work. Thank you so much for your research.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of the show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's, again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone with a corneal abrasion.
A few years ago, I had a significant corneal abrasion. Ever since then, every few months, my eye will hurt in the same spot when I first wake up in the morning, but the pain goes away within a few hours. Should I seek any treatment?
Bob, let me ask you a question. I said corneal, and Laura said corneal. How do you say it?
Corneal.
Corneal.
Yeah.
For our listeners, what is that?
That's the clear part in front of your pupil that you can see through very clearly as long as there's no injury to it.
Like almost like a translucent little membrane.
It's not the white thing that's around your eyes, the so-called sclera. It's the clear thing.
Kind of like a contact lens.
Kind of.
Kind of like a contact lens. And what happens to it? What can go wrong?
Well, I've had this myself. It can get an abrasion on it. That's a common problem. You can get something that gets in your eye, like a piece of leaf, or you can get somebody to take a swipe at you or whatever and get it, or a little kid sometimes will do it. And it's very painful. And the cornea turns over very fast. In fact, it turns over in about 4 days. So they heal relatively quickly. And if it's healed, you should be able to see through it clearly again. Sometimes a corneal scar occurs and that it doesn't go away. And then you have a spot in your vision.
Yeah, I remember I was wearing contacts as a young adolescent. And multiple times I would wake up having kept my contacts in overnight before they had these extended wear contacts. And getting that contact out, I would sure enough have a corneal abrasion. It would have dried out and cells would have died. One of the most painful things I can ever experience. And it would be that way for 8 or 10 hours. And then it would heal up and new cells would come in, kind of like a burn. Eventually the skin can grow back. But for that time being, incredibly painful. And this question, why is it still happening?
And the answer is, I don't really know. And if it's a good news that she doesn't have any symptoms between these episodes of pain. But I really believe somebody needs to have a look at her cornea with a fancy microscope and directional light called a slit lamp. And they also might want to do some testing with fluorescein, which is you can put a drop in and see if there's any irritation on the cornea. The other thing is she might have something on the flip side. So she might want to have somebody take and flip her eyelid upside down and see if there's not something there that's causing periodic irritation of the cornea.
Just the opposite of that advice to your mother. Don't invert your eyelid upside down.
Right.
It'll get stuck that way. This is one where you may want to do it with medical supervision.
Right. But I think she needs to have a slit lamp exam. Most primary care people don't do that in their office.
100% agree. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My mother's knees hurt her all the time and have for around a decade. She is in her early 80s. Steroid shots and painkillers help some, but don't make it go away. She sometimes talks about looking into knee replacement surgery, but more often than not, she's very hesitant to think about it. What do you think about knee replacement surgery at her age?
Well, first off, I am so sorry to hear that your mother has been in such pain for a decade now. You know, most people, they will think about knee surgery earlier because if they're in that much pain, chances are they really don't have any cartilage left around their knee if that's the cause of it. And they really benefit. I mean, knee replacement surgery is quality of life, probably one of the single highest in that hip replacement surgery, really for people functioning and staying healthy. So I think it's worth an evaluation at least to see if the arthritis is the cause. What do you think, Bob?
I agree. I think somebody needs to have at least a plain film, if not a fancier study made of her knees, and see what her cartilage is like and if there's little mini fractures and stuff that have built up and make the surfaces not smooth. So, and you know, I don't think 80s prohibits knee surgery, as provided two things. One, she's in pretty good health. And two, she knows that the rehabilitation on knees is very much more work than the hips that some of her friends might have had. But I don't think 80 should discourage her. On the other hand, if she's really reluctant to do it, then I'm not sure I would force her to do it. That's kind of her call.
Yeah, I think 80 is the new 90. And, you know, I had a relative that had knee surgery replacement when they were 91. They're 97 right now. Because, you know, if you're 91, you're going to live another 6 years. That's the, you know, that's the what the data charts would tell us. So let's not rule it out by age alone. Let's see how she's doing. An evaluation is not a bad idea. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Winter is on its way, and I'm dreading the dry, itchy skin that comes with it. Do you have any suggestions for keeping the itching at bay?
I do. One of them is get yourself some good skin moisturizers and put them on. You can cut your bathing back to every other day if you're not doing some kind of physical labor that's really hard. You can use very gentle soaps or no soap at all when you bathe and just wash off, because soap depletes your skin of oil, and that's a problem. You can also think about the environment you're living in, and perhaps you can put a humidifier on your furnace to make it so that the time you're in your own house anyway, you're not living in a real low humidity environment.
Yeah, you can put a drop or two of oil in the bath if you take a bath, so you, again, keep that skin kind of moist and avoid the drying out of the skin. Sometimes people need actually to see the doctor and get some prescription anti-inflammatory steroid creams to kind of our 1% hydrocortisone cream you can get over the counter that can help out with itching. We often say the first thing you should do is moisturizer. The second thing is moisturizer. And the third thing is moisturizer. On the other alternative, perhaps to keep it at bay, you could go to someplace that's tropical.
and relax.
And relax a little bit. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Antibiotics really impact my GI system when I take them. Unfortunately, I'm starting a round of them today. What are some ways to counteract my discomfort?
Well, this is difficult, and lots of questions we have here. First question I have is, okay, why are you taking the antibiotics? Do you really need those antibiotics? Because, you know, there are a lot of conditions which you might be able to get by without at least systemic antibiotics. One would be like acne. Some people are on lots of antibiotics like doxycycline, a type of tetracycline for acne, when they could perhaps get by with just topical measures and not subject your gut to antibiotics.
I think there's some other things you can do. Tell the prescriber that you have this issue and see what he or she wants to do about the drug, because some of them are more notorious for causing that than others. The other thing is, I always tell patients, when you're on a course of antibiotics, eat some active culture yogurt every day. Active culture means not pasteurized, where they've killed the bacteria. You're looking to repopulate your gut flora with lactobacillus, which is the active bacteria used to turn milk into yogurt.
Some people take a probiotic. I say if you're taking an antibiotic, you should be either on that active yogurt, as Bob says, or the probiotic. Sometimes taking antibiotics with food, so you take something on an empty stomach, it really can cause irritation of the gut and nausea. There's lots of ways here. You know, do you really need, again, that antibiotic? If it was a virus, sometimes people think, can you wait a day or two and use your natural immune system to boost it? Lots of ways of perhaps avoiding it, and then perhaps if you need them, take them for as little time as you need. If you can get by it for 5 days, don't take them for seven.
I agree.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. You can share your questions, stories, by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our health app. One word for a free download, Your Health. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great guest and reliable co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and our guest today, Dr. Beth McGinney. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.